What is your earliest musical experience, memory?
I think when I was maybe, I think maybe when I was a kid, like a young girl, my sister used to always play the hi-fi. Always. She used to always play these records like nonstop. She might play one song like 100 times. So I think that's my earliest memory in terms of just music in general. And of course, church, Not that I went to church a lot, but those are some of those are some of the things that I recall the most.
When did you first discover singing?
Well, I think singing discovered me, Randy. I didn't necessarily discover it. When I was a teenager and or a preteen, and everybody sings into the hairbrush, or sings
Yes.
into the comb or the. Everybody does that, and I did that with some of my girlfriends. Never even imagined that I could sing or wanted to sing. Although in high school, to get out of class, I joined the choir, so I could just not sit in class all day. I joined the choir and did that for a while, and actually had a gospel singing group. When I was in high school, so I could get out of class. But that's singing kind of found me late when I was, after I had kids and, had finished school and everything. Somebody just happened to hear me singing one day, and that's how singing found me.
And the rest is history.
This was not exactly singing was not my career choice.
Oh, it
I mean,
wasn't.
I just happened to be out. No, not at all. I never imagined that I would be a singer. It's not even something that I planned to do. I mean, I did all the things that all most little girls or young girls do. I'm going to be a singer, And beyond that, it was just not something that I pursued. Although I think there was a time, like maybe when I was 19 or 20 or early 20s, something. I went to an audition, or it was supposed to be an audition, to see about doing some background singing, simply because I needed money. Never thought that I could sing, but it was just something that, wow, I could use some money, I'm going to try it. But later on, somebody happened to hear me singing as I was outside sweeping my stoop, and they walked by and heard me, and it just so happened that it's a good guitar player friend of mine, who happened to be working at Philadelphia International Records. He was a guitar player, and he heard me sing, and he said, "Wow, you can sing!" And I'm just like, "Really? I can?" And he said, "You can really sing. You should let me audition you for a gig that I have coming up." And I didn't know what he was talking about, but he said the magic words, and which were, "I will pay you." That's how I got started. It was not, it was just by somebody walking by and hearing me and saying, "Wow, you can sing." Boom, they gave me a gig. I was green as grass. I didn't know anything about music. I still can't read music. I've had a gazillion teachers and I still can't read, but I just have like this inborn thing that I have an ear. I have an ear, and I'm told that I have a great sense of timing. So that's how it all started, by accident.
When you look back, the musicians of the 30s, 40s, 20s, that early period, the majority of them didn't even know how to read music or write music. Ella Fitzgerald,
Exactly.
is an example.
I mean, Ella Fitzgerald is there. Yeah, I mean, so many who didn't read music, who couldn't read music, and there was a period when I felt bad that I didn't or couldn't read music. I talked to some of the musicians that I work with about it, and they kind of felt like, "Well, you know what? You're fine. Don't worry about it." Because they know I had been really trying, and it was just something that I, maybe it's the math thing. I've never been good at math, so that could have something to do with it. I don't know, but they told me not to worry about it.
I'm gonna
Sometimes I do, and sometimes I just say, well, you know what? I can only be me.
Well, I'm gonna tell you something. I started off my radio show today with music from Bessie Smith from the late 1920s. Now, she was one of the greatest, I think, one of the greatest singers ever. And do you think she went to school to learn music? It was all from
Heck
within,
no.
you know?
Yeah, I mean, some things you just, and I don't know, sometimes I have a little issue with people who kind of look down on people who have inherent talent. It's just something that's inborn. It's something that's natural. It's not something that they studied. It's just something that they were born with. But some people have an issue with that. I mean, some of our greatest artists are not able to read music or have a limited ability to read. So, I just keep doing what I'm doing. God gave it to me, so I'm cool. I'm just going to keep doing it the way I do it.
If I remember correctly, I might be wrong here, but I don't think that Ellington and Basie, I'm not sure if they knew how to read music or not.
You know what? I don't know. I don't know, but so many of them just couldn't. They could not read music, but
Exactly.
it didn't stop them from saying what they had to say. It didn't stop them from saying what they had to say. Some things, I don't know. I just think that when we're born, some people are born with gifts. They're given abilities, that are just a part of their DNA. It's like something that's already programmed into us. Do we stop doing what we do because we can't read the roadmap? Or
That's right.
no, we just keep doing what we're doing.
Do you remember your first concert as a professional musician?
I do. I do. Oh my God. And you know what? It was soon after. It was the same guy who discovered me, quote unquote.
What was his
It
name?
was with the same guy who heard me. His name was Raymond Welsh, aka Rahman Rashid. He is deceased now, but he is responsible for getting me started in music. And the first professional concert that I did with him was in Philadelphia. It was at 24th and Pine at a park. About 7 o'clock at night, I was green as grass and I bombed. I was so nervous. I sang in the wrong key, and I didn't know anything about performing. I didn't know anything about how to handle an audience, how to work a mic or a stage. I was green. It was just like, I got thrown in the water, and they said, swim.
I'm going to tell you something. The great Art Blakey, I'll never forget this. He said, when you make a mistake, make sure it's nice and loud so everybody can hear it. And I never forgot that.
Wow. Make sure it's nice and loud so everybody can hear it.
Yes. How else are you going to learn?
Wow. Well, there you go. I mean, I just kind of felt like I bombed, and everybody did hear it. I mean, they were aware that I bombed, and I didn't, I felt bad, but it didn't stop me.
There you go.
It didn't stop me. What it didn't stop me, what almost stopped me was once I got into the gig life, of doing gigs and not getting paid, or doing gigs to an empty room, or doing gigs and what most musicians go through in terms of paying dues and that kind of business. Those are the things that made me almost stop, but it was never the music. It was never the music.
Who are
And every time that I thought that I would stop, a better gig came along.
Who are some of the people who have influenced you as a musician?
Oh, gracious. Musicians, I would say I love Ben Webster. I love Dexter Gordon. I love Chet Baker. Of course, you know, Miles and Coltrane, those guys. I love Nat Cole, Sarah Vaughan, Sweets Addison. I mean, there's so many, you know, but Sarah Vaughan in terms of vocally, Sarah Vaughan was and remains my hero. But I also enjoyed, I loved Frank Sinatra. My God, I'd been listening to Frank Sinatra since I was 13 years old. That's how I learned so many of the lyrics that I know by listening. I listened to Friday with Frank and Sunday with Sinatra with Sid Mark in Philadelphia on the radio every week. And that's how I learned all these songs. But later on, my uncle, I had an opportunity to live with an uncle during a few summers, and he had an extensive, Lee Morgan is another one that I really like. Benny Golson, you know, my uncle had an extensive record collection. He was an avid jazz fan. And a lot of the days when I would be there, you know, some in the summer, I would be in the rec room, you know, listening to his collection and learning this music. So I've been influenced by a lot of different people.
When I first heard you back in the 90s, when I first discovered you, there's one vocalist that I always thought that influenced you, and that was Helen Humes.
Really?
Yeah.
That's the first time that I've ever heard that.
Yeah, she's one of my favorite vocalists, and I always thought, man, there's a lot of Helen Humes in her singing, like aside from the obvious Sarah Vaughan, and maybe a bit of Carmen McRae, but Helen Humes, I don't know. I always thought that there was some, you know, Helen Humes in your vocal stylings.
And I have to be honest, I have heard her, but I haven't listened to her. I haven't listened to her extensively enough to, you know, to say, oh, wow, yeah. But I know that I do like her. I like her a lot because there was a station, WPEN in Philadelphia, that played, you know, the great the American Songbook, you know, mm-hmm. and classic standards and jazz and that kind of music, you know, your Hit Parade from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and some of her music was always featured. So she's somebody that I do like, but I can't say that I'm familiar enough with to say yes or no, but I will do my research as I always do.
Listen to her phrasing. Yeah, especially if you listen to some of her older recordings that she made back in the 40s. Mm-hmm. You know, I listen a lot to music from that period. And yeah, it's just a wonderful period in time for vocalists and for music in general, I think. And when you listen to her, her vocal phrasing is very, very wonderful to listen to.
Okay.
The way she articulates and everything. It's just really, really nice.
The thing is, Randy, I mean, the most important thing, and I think that a lot of singers now miss this, is the job of a vocalist is to tell the story.
Yes.
That is our responsibility. Our responsibility is to convey the emotion that the writer put into the words, you know? I mean, at least from where I sit, that's what one of the things that is most important. That writer, and now as I've started to write more, now I realize how important it is, you know, to convey what that writer was trying to say. Like when you think of a song like September Song or Tenderly or The Nearness of You, or even it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Hmm. I mean, you have to, as a singer, be able to convey that feeling to your audience. You have to be able to do that. And a lot of singers are missing that. A lot of singers nowadays are just kind of standing there. They're kind of just by rote, almost singing the words, you know, with little or no emotion. And I don't know, maybe it's me, but I need to feel something when I hear someone sing. I need to take a memory home with me.
I was watching one of the talent shows last week. I'm really addicted to them. I just love them. I love that kind of stuff. And one of the contestants was singing an Etta James song. And when she was singing it, like, I love Etta James. I'm sure you do as well.
Absolutely.
But there was nothing coming through. I mean, she was singing the song, but she wasn't singing the song, conveying,
exactly.
You know.
That's my point. I mean, anybody can sing a song, but to sing a song with the emotion that is attached to the words is what a singer is supposed to do. I also believe that on some level, you know, sometimes you have to live a song to really be able to sing it.
I agree.
But for singers, these singers have to realize that they're more than just words. It's a story. It's a story put to music. So it's our job to get that story told. Yeah, I mean, you have to. When people come to my shows, that is one of my biggest hopes, that they feel what I'm feeling when I sing, that they get it, that they understand, you know, mm-hmm. the sentiment behind the song that I'm singing, no matter if it's up-tempo, if it's a ballad, you know, a medium swing tune, that they get where the song is coming from.
I want to ask you about your uncle, Herbert Tatum. And what was his influence on you as a performer?
Well, he's the one who I stayed with during this couple of summers, who had the record collection.
Right.
So that impacted me greatly. I mean, just having access to that collection, you know, and he just kind of, you know, go for it. Listen, you know, I think more kids should be exposed to that, you know, should have an opportunity, especially now, since jazz allegedly is waning in popularity. Mm-hmm. It's very popular here in Europe, I can tell you that much.
Wow.
But I think his just his willingness to let me, you know, be a kid in a candy store, more or less, with his record collection was how he impacted me more than anything. So that's the part that he played in my musical career. He exposed me to jazz early on when I was 14, maybe 14, 13, 14.
Was he related to art?
No.
None?
Not at all. And, you know, well, you know, I say no, but I've never done the research. We could be related. I don't know. But Tatum is my mother's side of the family. They're Tatum. So.
Okay.
But I'll do the research. I'll find out, because I may be surprised.
Yeah, no kidding. We have something in common, and this is the next question. You and I worked in a hospital for 10 years, and it was the best experience in my life. And I want to know, what important lessons did you learn from working in a hospital?
Well, the most important thing that I learned, I think, is compassion. Mm-hmm. Compassion to treat everyone that you meet. Not that I didn't know it before, but to treat everyone with dignity and treat everyone as if they have an important story. You know, do you know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah,
treat them as if their lives are important, that they have value. That was the most important thing, because it's hard. A lot of people, I worked with an underserved population sometimes, and sometimes those people they fall through the cracks. Sometimes they are not treated in such a nice way. And, you know, I never wanted to be the person that behaved in that way. The other thing that I learned was to be precise with my work, you know, to be precise with my work. I always made sure that I worked in OBGYN, I worked in high-risk OB, I worked with cancer patients, to just make sure that my work was done and it was done well. It's the same thing that, it's the same way that I feel about my music. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it at the best I can. If, you know, if it's like, if it's not, if you don't do it, it's not, if you don't do it well, it's not worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah, that's how I feel. So those are some of the lessons that I learned. And I also, when I was working at the hospital, they used to call me the singing nurse because you know, I had the two jobs. I had the two careers running concurrently. I was, you know, med tech by day, and by night, you know, when I left the hospital, I'd run out and do some gigs and stuff. So I was a singing nurse. But what I learned even with that is you'd be surprised how, even when I would be singing mostly to myself, how it impacted people. And, you know, and I learned that music is medicine. Music is really medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It has healing powers. It has healing properties. And it should be, I mean, it's in terms of like homeopathy and alternative medicine, it should be incorporated into that type of treatment because it's healing. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to drop a couple of names to you from Philadelphia. Two of my favorites, Ray Bryant and Odeon Pope. What are your thoughts on these two musicians?
Well, I think they're trailblazers. That's it. Trailblazers. I think they should have especially Odeon Pope, who happens to be a friend of mine.
Mm.
I think they're deserving, especially Odeon is more deserving of a wider audience because, you know, I'm sure he has traveled. He's worked and he's traveled extensively, but I still think that his name should be one that is more frequently batted around than it is. Ray Bryant, of course, is very well known and set the tone and set the stage for so many young artists, you know, young up and coming artists. And I think that they do Philadelphia proud.
I couldn't agree more.
They do Philadelphia proud. So, you know, and I think that as well, they help to shape the direction of the music on a lot of levels. And that's pretty much it.
If you had only one living musician to perform with, who would it be and why?
One of the people that I really want to work with is here in Paris, and that's Kurt Leitze.
Oh,
really,
a pianist.
I really want to work with him. And actually have some things in the works to hopefully make that happen. Another one that I really want to work with is Archie Shepp, and I actually have a gig coming up with him.
Wow.
November 24th. So those are two. I mean, there's so many. It's just hard. It's hard to pick. It's hard to say. You know, I could have easily have said Cedar Walton, but he's gone. You know, he's gone. I met Barry Harris. He's somebody that I wouldn't mind working with. That's a toughie. That's something that I'd have to sit down and really think of. Because there's too many. It's too many of them.
Now, many years ago, you were a dancer.
I was. How did you know that? Did I tell you that?
No. I did some digging.
I was a dancer. I mean, I was a dancer, and of course, I was like maybe a whole lot of sizes smaller, but I danced. I loved dancing all my life. when I got in high school, I joined the dance club, you know, and did modern dancing under direction of Fay Snow, who later on was involved in Philadanko, which is the Philadelphia Dance Company, very, very well known and famous dance company here in Philadelphia in the States. And I got picked to audition for Philadanko when it was in its embryonic stages. It was not even, it was newly, being newly formed, and they were looking for people to dance. And I got picked when I auditioned, and my father wouldn't let me dance, but I continued to love dance. I did some African dancing with a few dancers who danced with Arthur Hall Dance Company. And I continue to dance to this day just for pleasure. But dancing was a big part of my life when I was young. I had varied interests. I had a lot of interest, you know. Music was something that I loved, but, you know, like I said, it was something to get me out of class. But exactly, it wasn't like, you know, I'm going to be some big music star or whatever. But I danced, and I also, I was an art major, so I paint and draw. And photography was something else that I was heavily into. You know, and some of these things I kind of left by the side of the road, you know, as life happened. Mm-hmm. But I'm at a point now where I'm going back to get my stuff. I'm going back to get some of the things that I left.
Now, you have a new recording out, mistaken.
I do. I have, I actually have a new project out with Olivier Hutman on a French label. Crystal Records, and it's a CD of mostly original material. I wrote three songs on it, and the music was all most of the music was composed by Olivier Hutman, and we threw in four standards for good measure. And the CD has been very, very well received. We actually just got a really great review in Jazz Times Magazine in the October issue. And I was really thrilled. You know, the one thing that I can say about our partnership is Olivier, along with the label, pushed me to write. Mm-hmm. I've always written. I've always loved to write most of my life. I would always write poetry and short stories. And one of my short stories was actually being considered for one of those chicken soup books. Yeah. And, you know, when I hooked up with the label and with Olivier, they said, we need you to write some lyrics. And I was like, write some lyrics? What are you talking about? I can't write anything. They said, oh, no, you don't understand. You are going to write some lyrics.
One thing I find really interesting about this recording is that you have a member of Gulliver's Travel on it.
Who's that? Gulliver's Travel, wait.
Ring any bells?
Gulliver's Travel. The person that I can think of that would be a member of Gulliver's Travel would be Steve Williams.
How about Daryl Hall?
Oh, Daryl!
Yeah.
Well, you just taught me something, darling.
Yeah, I used to listen to them before they were Hall & Oates.
No. This is a different Daryl. This is a completely different...
Oh, this is not the same one.
No, this is a completely different Daryl Hall.
No kidding. There's two Daryl Halls?
there are two Daryl Halls, and he always, I mean, we always have to make that distinction for him because people always say, oh my God, I used to listen to Hall & Oates all the time. Completely different Daryl Hall, but my Daryl Hall is equally as, he is just as popular in the jazz world as Daryl Hall. The other Daryl Hall is within his genre.
Yeah. I'm glad that we got that straight.
Yeah, but it's not uncommon. People do it often, so.
I've always thought of music like osmosis. You know, you keep listening to it and it just seeps in under your skin and it eventually finds its way to your soul, if you know what I mean. Do you have any
Yeah.
comments on that?
About the music and how it, well, sometimes, I think that you have to, in some instances, you have to listen to it more than once. You have to listen to it. Sometimes we find ourselves being casual listeners, like we'll put something on and then we'll listen to it, you know, and it brushes over us or washes over us. And then we put it on again, and you know, we might put something on casually and we're moving around. We're not really sitting around listening. We're just kind of moving around and doing stuff, and it's on. But when sometimes when you put something on and you sit down with the sole purpose, with the intent of listening to this music, you do. It seeps into your skin, and it does. Not saying that every composition will do that, but there are some pieces that absolutely do seep into your skin and touch your soul. They really hit home. You know, I've had people say to me that certain songs that I sing have, or they've listened to my recordings and they've gotten goosebumps, or you know, or some visceral reaction to the music. And to me, it just kind of lets you know that you're doing what you're supposed to do.
Now, when it comes to overcoming stage fright, did Sam use a particular technique?
Yeah, he did. He goosed me with his saxophone. That was the technique. He goosed me and I
Now,
jumped.
we're speaking of Sam,
Sam Reed.
exactly. Someone who I've just recently gotten into. He was on an album recently, and I'm trying to remember who it is. I really, really liked it a lot, and I featured it on my show, and I think he's still around, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, he's still around. Absolutely. He's still around and he's still playing. He's still around. He's still playing. He is still heavily involved in the Philadelphia music scene. You know, years ago, he was a band leader for the Uptown Theater in Philadelphia. And the Uptown Theater was kind of a place where all the African American headliners, you know, the stars would come through, and they'd have like matinees, and then they'd have evening shows, and they'd have jazz, and then they'd have soul and R&B music. And Sam was the band; he was the conductor of the band there, so he worked with everybody. He worked with everybody who's anybody.
What was the most satisfying concert that you ever saw?
I know this is going to sound really crazy, but I'm sorry. It is what it is. The best concert that I ever saw was Tina Turner. Yep, I'm sorry. It was Tina Turner because she is the consummate showwoman. She left us, I mean, she had us dancing from the time she hit the stage until she left the stage. And that is, it's my most memorable concert.
She's one of the very few women that I know that lays it all out on the stage. I've
She
seen her
does.
live as well. She's absolutely incredible.
She's amazing. I mean, this woman is stunning. First of all, she's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, she doesn't get tired, or seemingly doesn't get tired. You know, she gives her all. You know, sometimes I tell people, like when I come off stage, I tell them I left it all on the stage. That is what she does. She leaves it all. She gives her public. She just gives it to us, and I love it. I love it, and I love her.
She's always teaching us lessons how to perform and what it is to perform.
Always. I mean, always. And you know, but I think that's I kind of think that's something that is we can attribute to the more seasoned musicians and artists. You know, the artists that I grew up with, there is, you know, it's called, some people want to make a distinguish between, especially jazz artists, they want to make a distinguish between, a distinction between being an entertainer and a musician.
Right.
But the truth of the matter is there is no line. You are a musician and you are an entertainer. You know, people come to see us to be entertained. You know, just because we happen to be jazz artists does not mean that, you know, we get a pass. You have to do something to keep people coming to the venues and coming to filling the seats.
The consummate entertainers of all time, as far as I'm concerned, is Fats Waller.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, that guy, he just had a blast, you know, playing.
He's having fun.
Yeah.
He was having fun. He was up there laughing and goofing off and, you know, just having a great time. And that's, you know, I think that's just something that it's a model that we can all learn from. It doesn't have to be deep, you know, and I might get a ticket from the jazz police for saying this, but it does not have to be deep. It does not have to be, you know, so heady that people just don't get it. You know, you have to make that connection, and that's what Fats did. He made it fun, he made it funny, you know, and the true test or the is that his music still stands even now.
For sure.
You know?
Now, as a musician, what importance did Dexter Wansel have in your life?
Well, oh gracious, Dexter, we met at Philadelphia Internationals. It's all connected. We met through the guy who discovered me at Philadelphia International Records, where Dexter was the A&R director and a writer. You know, he was the band, he was the conductor of MFSB. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had a string of hits in the 70s, you know, and when I was going up there, just kind of demoing these songs for Rockman, Dexter happened to be there and we met, you know, he heard me, but he didn't really hear me, you know. Mm-hmm. But one night we were hanging out at this club, this restaurant, where they had live music in Philadelphia. And Dexter was there with a friend. And I was singing that night. And I had graduated from my stage fright and my ear gigs and you know, my real dues paying. And I graduated to doing this weekly gig at this restaurant. Dexter was there and he heard me singing. As I was leaving, coming off on break, and as I was leaving the stage, Dexter was sitting in the last seat at the bar. And I walked by and he kind of, you know, tapped me or grabbed my arm and he said, "Child, you can sing. You can sing."
Mm.
And he got my contact information and asked me to come and said he would call me and asked me to do some demo work for him. And that's how we worked. And later on, I went on to become his primary singer with his band, with his touring band. And that was after Gene Karn, I believe, was one of his earlier singers. So that was a thrill. I mean, just singing his music, and he's written so many great songs. And even to this day, you know, his music is being sampled by some of the rap artists and the, you know, R&B people. But he taught me a lot. He taught me a lot about the music and phrasing. You know, I had a habit of leaving the ends off of my word. You know, instead of saying words and making it audible, it would sound like I was saying singular word when it should have been word. So he taught me about the importance of sounding those words out and record different recording techniques. You know, he would not give me a pass. You know, we'd be recording and we might do one line like 60 times if he didn't think it was right. Yeah, I mean, he's brilliant. He's brilliant, and he's my friend, and I love him.
Did your parents have any idea how talented you were when you were growing up?
I think on some level they might have, you know, I think, but maybe, I don't know. I think my father did, maybe. My mom might have too. I don't know. I think they probably did, but, you know, when you're a kid, you don't pay attention. It's like, you know, you just like living, you know, goofing off and playing and, you know. I think they did because, let me amend that. I think they did because they did make sure that I was enrolled in terms of my art. They had me in a Saturday morning art program, you know, and then they had me in another program where I learned how to do silk screen and batik and that kind of thing, and sculpturing and wood block, that kind of thing. So they had me in those kind of programs. So they did, they knew, you know, but like I said, I was a kid. I was goofing off. I didn't know what they knew. I didn't care. They weren't like typical stage parents, you know.
Yeah.
Like hovering over me, you know, oh, you're going to dance. Oh, you're going to sing. No, it wasn't like that. So, but I think they knew that there was some talent.
When you go into the studio to make a recording, do you have a preset idea of what you want, or do you have a particular way of recording?
I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. I mean, I just like kind of go in and bam, I just do it. You know, I just know I want it to be good. And the last project that we did, the one that you just got, I think, you know, the day that we had to record, I was really sick. I have like a high sensitivity to mold. And I had been exposed to some mold and I got really sick the day that we were supposed to record. So I had to lay a rough vocal down for the musicians. And then I had to, when I left France, I had to re-record all my vocals in Philadelphia. Yeah, I re-recorded everything in Philly. And we kind of worked it out like that.
What is your favorite setting when you're singing, like a solo, duo, small group, big band?
I gotta tell you, I love one of my favorite performance venues is real intimate, like a real intimate space where I can be kind of up close and personal with the people, you know, where I can talk to the people and make eye contact with the people. And usually in, I love a quartet setting. I love it, you know. Favorite configuration is piano, bass, drums, and a saxophone. That's my favorite. That's my favorite. And my second favorite, I love to do a big band. I actually have a big band gig coming up again with Archie Shepp, and then with a big band here in France. I have a gig with them. But three. The first one is Carnegie Hall with my second dream. That's an orchestra with full strings. And last one is I would like to do the same thing at the Opera House in Australia. Yeah, that's what I'm actually. I have my agent is actually trying to work on getting me a gig with the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra. It would be amazing. It would be stunning. You know, with any orchestra would be stunning. And it's my dream. It's really something that I want to do. I would really like to recreate Billie Holiday's Lady in Satin, because that's one of my favorite records.
You've performed around the world now. Is there one concert that stands out for you as being the most memorable?
As a matter of fact, I did a concert in Italy. Well, it's two actually. I did a concert in Italy where there were like 3,000 people. And I mean, I did a my rendition of O Sole Mio. And the response from the audience, I mean, the whole night, the response from the audience was just stunning. You know, it was just incredible. The stars were out. It was beautiful. I can't even remember what city or what town I was in. It was one of the most beautiful things that that I've done. And the second one was actually recently when I was in Marseillac in France. Had a lot of great concerts here in France, and have been so, I mean, have been so well received throughout Europe, you know. But Marciac was really good because the first night that we had the concert, you know, I think we were there for two or 3 days, maybe 2 days. It was 2 days. We had two shows a day, so the first show was like maybe close to 500,000 people. The second show on the first day, we were a little more people, but by the second day, there were maybe 2,000, 2,500 people. And to see those people dancing to jazz was a thrill. It was absolutely thrilling. Yeah, it's a memory. I have so many beautiful memories. You know, I've been so dearly embraced, and I'm trying so hard to get to Canada to share their music with people there. But I've been so beautifully embraced here in Europe, and it's humbling. It's a humbling experience for me, and it just confirms for me that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm doing what I was put here to do.
How did bebop and books and Friday Night Jazz at Cedar Park come about?
You know, in my career, that those two things are the things that I think I'm most proud of, because it was not and was never about me. How it was born, I went for a walk with my boyfriend at the time. I walked through the neighborhood. I lived in West Philly, but I lived in a kind of a section of the city that was kind of a mix of people, different ethnicities, and you know, different types of restaurants, and you know, the architecture, the buildings were beautiful old, you know, old these old, beautiful old houses. And you know, I mean, the neighborhood had everything. It just had everything. But the one thing, in my opinion, that was missing was jazz. So I had done a thing with some musicians that I had worked with at this Firehouse Farmers Market. And I said, and I knew that he had space up on the second floor. So my first thought was to possibly open a club. But after conferring with my pocketbook said, "You have lost your mind. You can't afford to open a club." So what I did, I went to went to the firehouse and the market. And went to the guy's office, which was on like a loft, a second floor loft. And I wrote a note on a yellow sticky, and it said something to the effect of, "I'm interested in doing some jazz here at your market. Please call me." So he called me, and at the time he was trying to increase his visibility and increase his patrons at his market. He wanted more customers. He said, "Listen, if you can book the music, I'll help you find the money to pay the musicians. And so that's how it was born, That's how it all started. I quickly started booking some people. We ran from the end of May until we ran from the end of May until the first week in September, like from Memorial Day to Labor Day.
Wow.
And a lot of, for the first, say, maybe 5, 6 years, we had a huge sponsor who was covering most of the financial end of it. And we had other neighborhood organizations who were contributors. And we were able to pay the musicians. It wasn't a lot, but we were able to pay them. It was a staff of just three, four people. It was me, had a woman who was a grant writer, and the owner of the market. And we ran it. We pulled it together and first started out the first concert. I think there were maybe 25 people. And as weeks went by, it just grew and grew until every Friday. The concerts would run every Friday. They were free. People had to bring their lawn chairs, and a lot of people would pack picnics and, that kind of thing. But by the time we got to like the 7th year, there were between any every week there were between there could be between two and I think one for a couple shows we had maybe 600 people, and this was in a neighborhood, an inner city neighborhood in West Philadelphia. Bebop and Books was born out of the fact that the children were running amok. Their parents would come to enjoy the music, and the kids were out of control. I mean, they were running all over the place. They were climbing on stuff. They were acting crazy. So one day I just said I couldn't take it because I have kids, and I'm like, look, you know what? No, this is not gonna work. So I gathered them all together, and I took a poll. I said, okay, kids, what do you like to do? And of course, the first answer was play. I got that. I said, but after playing, what do you like to do? And the consensus was read. We like to read. So I said, okay, these kids like to read, then what I'm going to do, I'm going to appeal to the adults in the audience to donate books so that these kids can read. And at this time, I think I was passing the bucket to help generate more funds because one of our funding sources had dried up. So I would pass this bucket every week, and with the bucket money, I would buy books. And and I'd make them available to the kids every week. They knew that their books would be in a bin. They could come and take them. They could bring them back. They could trade them, and at the same time they were being exposed to jazz and learning the music. I mean, some of these kids had never seen live instruments before. It was just a new experience for them. It was a new experience for them. And a lot of times, I mean, the kids would get the books. You would see the parents sitting in the grass, reading to the children while they were listening to the music. It was beautiful.